Today is December 25th, observed as a Christmas holiday. We'd like to wish all of you a very Merry Christmas, and a week from today will be the new year, 2025. So you can imagine here at 90.7 FM KPFK Radio, we're looking forward at another great year of bringing you the best of programming. Enjoy the holidays, and from all of us at KPFK Radio, go forth and prosper.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. It's been 40 years since the groundbreaking anthology, This Bridge Called My Back, writings by radical women of color, was first published. And today on the show, we're honored to be joined by co-editor Sherry Moraga to hear about the history and the impact of the book and about the anniversary event coming up Friday this week. We start off with an iconic poem from the anthology. It's called The Bridge Poem by Black lesbian poet Kate Rushen. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Bridge poem. I've had enough. I'm sick of seeing and touching both sides of things. Sick of being the bridge for everybody. Nobody can talk to anybody without me, right? I explain my mother to my father to my little sister to my brother to the white feminist to the black church folks to the ex-hippies to the black separatists to the artists, and the artists to the parents of my friends. Then I've got to explain myself to everybody. I do more translating than the UN. Forget it. I'm sick of filling in your gaps. Sick of being your insurance against the isolation of your self-imposed limitations. Sick of being the crazy at your holiday dinners, the odd one at your Sunday brunches. I am sick of being the sole black friend to 34 individual white folks. Find another connection to the rest of the world. Something else to make you legitimate. Some other way to be political and hip. I will not be the bridge to your womanhood. Your manhood, your humanness. I'm sick of reminding you not to close off too tight for too long. Sick of mediating with your worst self on behalf of your better selves. Sick of having to remind you to breathe before you suffocate your own fool self. Forget it. Stretch or drown. Evolve or die. You see, it's like this. The bridge I must be is the bridge to my own power. I must translate my own fears, mediate my own weaknesses. I must be the bridge to nowhere but my own true self. It's only then I can be useful.
This Bridge Called My Back turns 40, and it's an amazing celebration. I mean, it's hard to believe that it's been 40 years since the groundbreaking anthology, This Bridge Called My Back, writings by radical women of color, edited by Sherry Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa, was first published. And this Friday, the anniversary edition is being celebrated with an intergenerational honoring of ancestor contributors with testimonials and poetry by those still around to tell the story and inscribe a necessary future. Today, we're honored to be joined by co-editor Sherry Moraga, who's an iconic Chicana writer, feminist activist, poet, essayist, and playwright. And also joining me as a guest co-host today is Wanda Alacon, who's an assistant professor of practice in gender and women's studies at the University of Arizona. Welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Great, thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Sherry, for listeners who may not be familiar with the anthology or who may need a reminder, can you just start by telling us about some of the stellar contributors and describing just a little bit of like the depth and the breadth of the voices and visions included in this amazing anthology?
Well, that's kind of a huge question.
Yeah.
You know, I guess what I have to say is when we started this project in the late 70s, Gloria and I were very unpublished writers. Mm-hmm. And so when you're saying you were sort of the kind of like best known figures, et cetera, I think it's important to say is that our initial impetus to do this had very little to do with that. It had very little to do with people necessarily that were well known, but we ended up getting some very key Black feminist support at that time. And the people that come to my mind right now are, of course, Audre Lorde, Toni K. Bambara, who wrote the foreword, and Barbara Smith, who was a, you know, key member of the Combahee River Collective. So those Black sisters, you know, really, and locally, and I say locally because I was in the Bay Area at that time, Pat Parker, many people that aren't aware of Pat Parker's work, but just fierce Black lesbian writer, and very connected with Audre Lorde. So they were like these key, really important figures for us, because when Gloria Anzaldúa and I decided to do this collection, it was really because we had been very involved in working as poets more than anything else, you know, in the burgeoning women of color cultural movement in the late 70s in the greater Bay Area, San Francisco and Berkeley and Oakland. And through our doing this, you know, work, we were meeting a lot of other women of color writers, in particular Asian American women like Jenny Lim and Nellie Wong, Merle Wu, and beginning to try to also cultivate relations with Native writers. One in particular in the Bay Area was Barbara Cameron. So people that know the book can also know now that some of those writers like Christos, has many of the writers now in the book have national reputations. The people that had the national reputation at that time, as I said, was largely African American women. So for them, you know, we had this idea of responding to what we understood was what we experienced very kind of brutally, the racism of the white women's movement at that time, and its exclusion, its racism and classism of women of color writers and thinkers and activists. And so the book was originated out of that impulse. But once we started it, it went someplace, not entirely different, because there's still a lot of critique of those issues, which remains the case in many ways. But what it did is it really gave us an opportunity as women of color from very diverse communities to finally speak together in between the covers of a book. And so what I always credit, you know, Audre and Barbara and, you know, Toni Cade, is they could see, they were called to also communicate with us. And by virtue of their visibility, it gave all these other women of color too visibility. And so I always remain really, you know, very beholden and grateful to them for that, because in a certain way there was a women of color movement happening, at least, you know, really from the mid-70s, really, that was intercultural, but it didn't have that much visibility because there wasn't that much being documented about it. There was a Third World Women's Alliance that was also in the Bay Area and in New York. They were amazing, and they had Bit began a publication. And so there was all this stuff burgeoning, you know, but somehow it was this particular book that seems to have lasted over time. 40 years, yeah, you're right, it's a long time.
It's, yeah, amazing. And it's such a rich mixture. I mean, there's personal essays, criticism, interviews, testimonials, and also poetry and visual art. So it's this multi-layered book. And Wanda, just to bring you in, what was your first impression? And I've heard from so many folks and seen so many clips online from people saying how much the book changed their lives. So I wanted to hear from you, you know, before you start bringing in some of your questions, how that was for you.
Absolutely. The book is so fundamentally important to my thinking and everything that I do. And I write about Chicana literature. That's primarily what I do. My framework is woman of color feminisms and decolonial feminist thought, you know, kind of together. And so that's kind of an unusual combination for some, because there seems to be this sort of like, if you write about Chicana anything, literature, right? Then therefore the theories that inform your thinking is Chicana feminism, right? And that's part of the picture, but I find that we lose a lot when we do not think of Chicana feminisms as being part of coalitional histories with women of color, right? And so in that sense, it is a really fundamental, large, important framework for my thinking that requires both decolonial feminist thinking and women of color feminism. But to answer that first question, Lynn, I have to say, and I was wondering, Sheree, if how it feels to you to imagine, and maybe you got this reception as well. But when I first encountered the book myself, you know, I had trouble with the cover, with the image. I have to say that my response was not warm. I had a hard time with that. And so seeing this figure, a drawing of a woman nude on all fours, you know, and this idea of the bridge, I'm like, oh, I struggled with that. And so I don't want to say I fought it, but, you know, but I did resent it, you know. And what helped me so much was reading Tona K. Bambara, all the forewords, you know, but also the Kate Russian poem, you know, the bridge poem, because it captures that exhaustion, like, because we so often do not have the choice. You know, we are the bridges in our families. You know, we are the bridges in our communities. I had to kind of work my way through the politics of bridge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, so now that, you know, the 2002 version has Ana Mendieta's image.
Yes.
And the since 2015, the back is standing up. And the back is made of corn. And that was an image right on, yeah. And that's the new version has that too, of the different color, but the corn, the spine. It wasn't until 2002 that the visual images, you know, the multiple visual images in color came in, and those were curated by Celia Herrera Rodriguez,
yeah.
and so that idea of the spine also being made of corn representing indigenous women was pretty significant. And if you see there's a drawing of it. If people go to this event on Friday, you're going to see the original drawing that said it conceived for the hand drawing that where the cover image is generated from. And it really is that. So I love that you had that reaction to the cover. And what's also cool is that if you, I encourage people to attend, because I asked Kate Russian, you know, to read that poem again, and you know, some of the work is live, and some of the work was pre-recorded for the event, and she read it in a way I've never heard her read it in my life. What was really impressive to me about it is I remember her reading it as of 40 years ago, so she was a lot younger, and she had all this like, you know, kind of like all this, you know, youthful energy, like. I always remember the line where she'd say, I've done more translating than the goddamn UN, being all pissed off, but, you know, spirited, right? And now her anger is deep. It is deep. Because it's, you know, I'm not sure exactly, but I know the kids around my age, so it's like at least late 60s deep as a black woman, you know. And it's impressive to me. It's impressive. In other words, that you know, like when you really think about those pieces, that's been an interesting thing to kind of go back and be able to record some of the sisters from the original and just seeing the depth and the complexity of what they know now. So the bridge and that idea of this bridge called My Back really just came, you know, it had come to me when I was in Boston when I originally met Barbara Smith and some of the women from Gumbaki. And I happened to, and it was funny, so I wrote that piece, This Bridge Gets Walked Over, This Bridge Called My Back, you know, and then many, you know, a little while later, Kate had this poem, the bridge poem. It wasn't written for the book. It was like she had it. So it's like, it just was perfect, you know, it's like collective thinking.
Yeah. That is a wonderful, I am so curious about the formation of it, you know, how it came to be. And that's actually a question I had, you know, did you ask Donna for the poem or was it already, you know, there? So you've in a way kind of answered one of my secret questions, you know.
It's not a secret.
Sheree, I love how you said that the 2015 edition, that the illustrations that accompany all the subsections now were curated by Celia, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And so one of the things that I like to, when I teach a class called U.S. Rural Feminisms, mm-hmm. Regularly, it's one that I teach. I also teach the Gateway, the Introduction to Gender Studies class. And so there is always a unit or two units on bridge. So I'm always teaching bridge and always trying to find different ways of introducing it or presenting it to students, you know? Mm-hmm. And so one way with my kind of lit background is I, you know, the form of it, right? You know, how people have, scholars of bridge have called it, it's a history or it's an event or it's an archive, you know, that it's not just an anthology. It is an anthology, yes, but it is also historical, an event, some say performance, an archive. I propose it's a soundscape, you know, all these ways of capturing, you know, a coalitional politics, right? You know, and Cindy Cruz would say it's a primer, right? Because there's a pedagogy to bridge, you know, right? And to that, we can now add a gallery, right? And I am curious about the drawings, you know, like they're very compelling. The ones in the first editions, you know, the black and white, like bus stop, like I'm just so moved by these images, you know, and I wondered how you made, was it a difficult move to go from that kind of history of bridge to now featuring, of course, the very important work of these artists of color in the editions.
Yeah, the idea, I mean, somebody could do a study on every edition of Bridge. I mean, the first, within 2 years, the book was redone by Kitchen Table Women of Color Press. That we had to wrest the book from the original publishers, Persephone Press, which in the beginning, they were wonderful to work with, a white feminist press that had really distributed the book very widely. But when it really came down to it and we wanted rights to the book back because the press was falling apart, it wasn't an easy move. I mean, we had to get lawyers. We had to do all of the typical white capitalist patriarchal stuff, you know. But when we did it, we really wanted to keep the book in print. We moved quickly. And so partly the book is pretty much like the initial, including the artwork. And one of the ideas is that at that time when we were doing the book, and we were working with Persephone, was basically trying to find, you know, a woman of color who could do the illustrations. And Janetta Tinker was there. And, I mean, I guess she was a Boston. I'm trying to think. She must have been a Boston-based artist. And, you know, she had these beautiful drawings. But by the time we got to 2002, and the book went out of print for a period of time, because after Kitchen Table Press was no longer functioning, then the book went out of print. And then Third Woman Press out of Berkeley, and Norma Alarcón was a publisher of Third Woman Press coming out of UC Berkeley. And she, you know, we all knew each other, right? We all knew each other. And Celia had always said, you know, why is it we don't have, you know, this is another language, the visual is another language. Why don't we have representation of the visual artists from that period of time? And she was really right, you know. So we said, okay, do it. So she went and did it. So actually, if you have the 2002 version, that has a whole, you know, centerpiece that has much more work, and it's all in color. And when we went to SUNY Press, we wanted that again, but they wouldn't, you know, the cost, right? It's always cost stuff, right? But that work is there now, and it is a, and it does represent a much wider group of artists than the later versions has. But it really is, the whole point was, you know, as we're talking about the writers of 1981, who were the visual artists of that period. And Celia, as a visual artist, also has, you know, contextualized that work. And what's also been really kind of hard and interesting about it is that are the number of people that have passed, and so, particularly the visual artists like Ana Mendieta, and Teresa, I can never say her name correctly, I'm sorry. But there are, you know, people that passed really early deaths, and there's reference also to Victoria Mercado and Marcia Gomez, and a lot of them died early deaths. So having them there and having them within the context of women of color feminism was really important. I thought the idea to have Ana Mendieta on the 2002 cover was brilliant, you know, just brilliant. And so, you know, but the other people said, oh, no, we need to bring back the body. And, you know, everybody's got ideas, you know. So it's all good. I mean, it's all good. But I think that since you're talking about scholars, I mean, that's something to look at, is to really look at all the editions and see what they say about us, you know, about women of color movement, about our expressions, etc.
I'm also really interested in talking about something that you mentioned in the 2015 edition, about the concept of political memory. And you wrote, in order to ensure that we are not always reimagining ourselves the ever inventors of our revolution, how each edition brings that question back. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, one thing with all the editions, even since 1983, one of the titles of one of the prefaces that I did was called Refugees of a World on Fire. And what I'm finding, it's not hard. What I'm finding is everything, I'm just speaking for myself here, that but in contextualizing each of the editions, they seem prophetic, and they're not. They're just true. You know, and I guess that's the horror of it, really, on a certain level. Because if in 82 you can talk about the world being refugees of a world on fire, where are we now? So there's a way in which that the 2001 version, I wrote 2001, which, and that title was From Inside the First World. And I began writing it on the morning of 9/11, because that happened to be the day that I had put aside to write, right? You know, you have it on your calendar, I'm just going to, oh, today's my writing day. And we woke up to the giving our kids breakfast, you know, and as we were, had the news on in the morning, and we're seeing the Twin Towers go, right? And so, and the first thing you think, you look at it and you say, you know, the U.S. is completely complicit. That's the first thing that comes to your mind. You know, you're a conscious human being, and your kids are looking at it. My son's like 8, and he's looking at it, and he asks me, who are the bad guys? Who are the bad guys? I don't get it. Who are the bad guys? You know, and it's like, and I go, good question. Good question. This is where we start, you know. So the point being is that every single time there was a new edition, you know, there was something else. I look at them and there's always like this little litany kind of goes on, what are the current issues, you know? And so then you're talking about the war in El Salvador at one period of time. You're talking about, you know, so it's like each time, you know, then there was the Occupy movement. And so there's progressive things that are happening at the same time, progressive responses, but by and large, the degree to which you can mark in those forewords and prefaces and, you know, all the things that they're called, the introductions, the degree you can mark really, really the deterioration of what we understand really as true democracy, not all the language of it, but, and also, of course, the condition of the planet. So by this version now, the one thing I found myself with this preface, I had a really hard time with it, because we were coming out of Black Lives Matter, and we're not coming out of anything, but I'm saying, but still, in pandemic, like all of these things are on the street, and you know, the disproportionate amount of people of color being impacted by that, and women of color being impacted. Everything is quite evident that was 40, you're supposed to write something that's 40 years later. And each time, I have to admit, sometimes I'm less and less optimistic. It's like I always have, it's like, you know, as you know, I write theater, you know, and so a lot of times people say to me, you know, like sometimes they're sad, they're really sad, you know, I mean, it's like there's tragedy, right? And they'll say, why do you write, tragedies? I said, if you look at the tragedies, like inside of it, they're not tragic because there's always movement. There's always this place in which that, like opening that wound, you know, helps you realize what we need to do to get well, right? And so I have felt this way, this particular writing, because I just returned back to Christos's last line of the book, which is, I will be screaming, no, no more destruction, in that last blinding light. And that was in 1981, right? She's saying that then. Is she a prophet? Of course she's a prophet. But we're all prophets. You know what I'm saying? If you're paying attention, it doesn't have to, you know, you see what's coming down the road. And I think that that's why Bridge still works. Because these were very, very conscienced women, speakers, who were writing not as academics. In fact, the first things that we got, we were from academics, because academics at that time were the only people who thought they could write in terms of women of color, right? And we just turned them back. We gave them back. We didn't want that. So when you're talking about the testimonials and you're talking about, you know, I mean, some of like Rosario Morales's pieces are some of the best pieces in the book, Puerto Ricana. And hers, she sent them to me handwritten notes. I can't write. I can't write. This is why I can't write. She writes all this stuff. And we just pulled it out, used it, you know, and you know, say Gloria wrote Christos's pieces. And so all mm-hmm. I want to say is about the remembering and why it's important to know the histories, right? Because the truth of the matter is, and I teach young people, I'm still teaching 20-year-olds, you know, I mean, it's like I've been doing it for 40 years. And the longer you teach, you realize how deeply the amnesia is, you know. And without that body of knowledge, right, they always have to start from scratch. And it's too late to start from scratch. The condition of this world is too late to start from scratch, you know. And they have to know what happened before them and the tools that were used then. Why create new tools, you know? It's because these were not the master's tools that were being used. You know, Audrey said, don't use the master's tools. They will not dismantle the master's tools. But we didn't use the master's tools. And partly the writing is not the master's tools because it is visceral. It is theory in the flesh. It is coming out of lived experience, right? Now we have tons of academic language for it. But it doesn't necessarily mean we're any closer to knowing what that means, right, in terms of relationship to heart knowledge.
This is such music to my ears, Cherie, because I mean, I also teach 19, 20-year-olds. And so what I find helps me, I think it is important to kind of examine the form and the way Bridge takes up, you know, a form that is the anthology that has been used to authorize a particular kind of writing, particular kind of knowledge, right? And the way it takes up the form, but in this radical anti-canonical way, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that kind of helps me, yes, it is kind of highly periodized for some people, you know, to a certain decade, right? You know, but the way I approach it is to have students, and this is where listening helps me tune into kind of like the ongoing reverberations or the influence of the work that Bridge did, right? And so, for instance, a concept like intersectionality right now from Combahee River Collective's, you know, Black Feminist Statement, right? Young people understand in a very popular sense a definition or an understanding of intersectionality, you know, so they already know that, you know, they already kind of, that is part of kind of like what shows up on their social media, you know, sort of readings, right? And so I know that young people are feeling the influence of Bridge. And so part of my work is to kind of have context, historical context, right? You know, for like where Bridge came out, you know, alongside with anthologies like But Some of Us Are Brave or Making Waves, kind of its contemporaries, right? But then also to not think, well, just because it's got this specific publication date, right, that we cannot see the lasting work of Bridge. So this is all to say I'm into the idea of reverberations. And what helps me with that is M. Jackie Alexander, who devotes a chapter in her book, Pedagogies of Crossing, mm-hmm. called Remembering This Bridge Called My Back, Remembering mm-hmm. Ourselves, right? And so she's, you know, a Caribbean feminist, right? And so she says this, she says, I was not part of the sweat and fire that birthed a woman of color politics in this country in the 1970s and 1980s. This is why I want to remember that I have been shaped by it. And she writes about sharing what she calls a politicized non-belonging with the writers in Bridge, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of to echo the Lynn's question about the political memory, right? You know, but this is sort of one of the ways, the kind of the links that I try to show students that we are all, like, I mean, I am older than my students, but I also was not part of that movement, right? Mm-hmm. I encountered these ideas, politics, you know, through Bridge itself, the materiality of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I see many reverberations of the concept of solidarity expressed in, say, US-Third World, like connected to the third world, right? You know, the concept of theory in the flesh, which for many people now, theories of embodiment, right, is kind of how they understand that concept in part. You know, there's all these new coalitions, right? But one of the most important concepts for me is the theory meeting the practice, you know, and specifically through the writing. And I love that in the 2015 introduction that Catching Fire, you insist like writing that continues to be this tool like of liberation, right, for women of color. And so I'm struck by the not just the kind of writing that there is, but there's also like forms that are important in Bridge. Like there's so many letters in Bridge. And there's also the many sort of daughter-mother writings, you know.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine, and we're talking to Sherry Moraga, co-editor of This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color. And Wanda Alakon is our guest host today, and we'll be back after the break.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for your donations and overwhelming support of this listener-sponsored community radio, KPFK. It is the support of listeners like you that keeps this station strong, fiercely independent, and powered by the people. Thank you from all of us at Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up right now is part two of our interview about This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color, the 40th anniversary edition. And we're talking to co-editor Sherry Moraga with guest host today, Wanda Alakon.
When you mentioned the thing about intersectionality, and I mean, I just, for the first time actually in my life, I actually taught a full course on Bridge. I never have. I've used it on a couple occasions, like little excerpts and stuff, but I usually don't. It's only lately I've started to actually teach any of my own work, my other work, of course. And I think it's just because I got tired of, part of me got tired of not admitting the fact that I said that, I wrote that. You know, and the sense of like, I like always just kind of go, you know, it's like, it's a hard thing for me to explain, but it's like on a certain level, it's like when one teaches, I mean, what I do for all my years of teaching and teaching creative writing and, you know, all the political theory we're talking about, et cetera, You know, I feel like what really generates it is my writing. I mean, that's how I know things. I know things because I'm writing them. I know things because I've had to ask those same questions of myself. And the writing is generated out of questions, is generated out of contradictions, is generated out of paradox, is generated out of absence, right? So that's why I write. So I'm trying to teach my students, and what I know, it's like so what I'm teaching them is what has been generated out of my own writing. And so at a certain point, I go, just read the book. just read the book. And I'm not talking about bridge necessarily. I'm just talking about these, you know, like when you were talking mother-daughter, I have Native Country of the Heart. There's a whole memoir about my relationship with my mother. So finally I said, just read the book. Let's talk about our relationships and let's use my journeying to help you make your journey. And I taught this critical creative writing class in creative nonfiction with, you know, a group of undergrads and grad students. And it was one of the best teaching experiences I had because I didn't have to fake it. Like, I didn't know. It's like, I'm going, no, really, this is really a practice. This is a practice. And it will free you. I promise you, hang in there, you know, and being able to do that. So for the first time, because I, you know, also because Bridge was heading his 40th, I decided I was going to teach This Bridge Called My Back. And, you know, I had, you know, I was very fortunate. I had, you know, a colleague of mine in Chicano studies. I'm in the English department at UC Santa Barbara. And one of my colleagues is Sheila Sandoval, right? And so she, you know, the methodology of the oppressed, she came and lectured to those students, right? And Celia is teaching Chicano studies, and she came and did her own presentation on the visual work. You know, and then I had Margot Okasawa Rey from the original Kumbaki also presented. It was like, this is heaven, this is great, you know. But the thing that all that's to say is what I realized is they didn't know what intersectionality was. They really didn't know. And there was a 200-person lecture, right? So that's a lot of students, right? And you had great TAs, women color TAs. And really and truly, my experience was that they had the language to it, and it was almost that the facility and the language was covering the knowledge, that they were fluid, that they were literate in languages. But it didn't necessarily mean that they got it. And the thing that I still love about Bridge, and I'm kind of going, it wasn't like I've long minute, 20 years, I wasn't even paying attention to the book anymore. It's like, you know, even myself kind of going, well, am I? It was through going back this time in a certain way and also communicating with the authors, et cetera, that have gone very far in their own lives, in their own ways, on their own paths. But there is a viscerality in the writing. I remember how we were allowed to write when we were young women of color. I remember that. I remember we took great risks. I remember nobody was telling that you can't use that word. I remember like that phrase doesn't have to be like me. And it's like you could find original voice. And I feel like with the corporatization of the academy, this is getting beaten out of these children, you know. And I feel that passionately, and I will go down saying that, right? Because it is like for me to get them to do it, and then particularly the ones in graduate school, because by the time, you know, they're in graduate school, they've lost voice. Some of these people are really wonderful writers. It's right there at their fingertips, but there's no body in it. Right. So the theory in the flesh was literal. It's like if it don't hurt when you're writing it, you didn't write it. You know, it just if there's no risk, you didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And so how do you cultivate the right? And this is also what I've written about many times in Chicano Codex. It was like, how do you write? How do you legitimate? How do you give people the right to write, which is the right to remember? Right. Which goes back to the earlier point about remember, you know, it's like about the past. And I saw that through my students' eyes now, because they're like kind of like feeling like some stuff is scandalous. You know, it's like they're going, my God, this is so like, and they're telling me, they're going, this is so intense. They're saying stuff like that. They go, God, it's so what? I go, what? They go, just raw. And like, you know what I mean? Like that, right? And I think, you know, Gloria's pieces are very reflective of that. You know, the students are going to do like a speaking in tongues stage reading of part of it like that. You know, and then, you know, she says, I mean, on the radio, you can't say the S-H-I-T word, but it's like, you know, so, you know, she says, but put your blank on the page, you know, put it on the page. I mean, just like con fuerza, you know. So there's something that I have to admit that I have a renewed appreciation, and that is not to romanticize this thing at all. It's not about that. It's that in teaching young people 40 years, you know, younger, this book, you know, it's more than 40 years in my case. Like, I mean, in terms of like the age of the students, you know, like I'm not 60, I'm looking at 70. And so it's like teaching them and seeing how they're almost like their innocence in a certain level, because language has the access, you know, social media, they lack the access to such quick languages for things. In my experience, you know, has sheltered them from the visceral interaction with their own lives. Trigger warnings do that. If everything has to have a trigger warning before you say it, get ready. I'm going to say something that's going to scare you or might upset you. And I say that with all due respect to people that are survivors in all these violences. And I know from teaching the arts is that if you are in good hands, you don't need the trigger warning, because there has to be guides to help you, one, get well, but also make beauty from those broken places. That's been my impression of going back right now to this, which I never plan to really teach bridge.
That's also part of like understanding what we're here to do, you know, or what some of us are here to do in these now disciplined fields of gender studies, right? Ethnic studies, right? If we only think of them as sort of to gain some kind of fluency so that we can have better chances at a certain kind of, like, I don't like this approach of the study of gender and the study of race, you know, in that way. And something like the idea, the notion of a trigger warning, that just doesn't fit, right? Because the problems that we are dealing with in terms of race and gender are huge. You know, they exceed so much, you know, where the idea of the trigger warning is coming from. And so, like, we're talking about these deep, deep, deep injustices. We're talking about these ongoing kind of histories and continuation of violence. So it's also about understanding, you know, like, well, what are we here to do when we do study race and when we do study gender, you know, together, right? But I do so love teaching bridge for these reasons. I know they're familiar with some of the ideas, but then I like to give them the, you know, let's read Kambahi, let's read all of it, let's read it and see if we can grasp the nuance of the difference of the concept of like the simultaneity of interlocking oppressions or system of oppression versus the critical race theoretical context of intersectionality, and not kind of pit them against each other, but to understand the particularity of the context from which they come from, right?
Exactly. Another big question, Sheree. Over these 40 years, how feminism in the US has been changed by the book? It's so clearly called out white feminists of the second wave in, as you say, the core beginning of the book, and then became part of the larger conversation there. But in so many ways, that conversation has kept happening, right?
Yes, I think what's changed is a transnational women of color movement. I mean, I really love the idea, you know, in the 70s, which in the early 80s, it got kind of forgotten, is about identifying as third world women in the United States. Mm-hmm. I love that idea. And, you know, I know that also it's, you know, it's problematic in its own way in terms of First Nation people, et cetera. But it related us to the third world. It related our origin stories as internally colonized people. And some of that language has been lost. I mean, you know, and even in decolonization, we talk about, you know, our decolonial theory. We're not really, I think that was a really great position for us to identify politically as women of color, as internally colonized, and that sometimes it gets missed somewhat under languages like settler colonialism and all this kind of stuff. And there's a lot of contradictions in all this language. So I don't want to go down that road. But what I was trying to say, though, is that I feel like, so what has emerged, and also thinking about really that the global South, you know, as really being the origin stories. And when I think about the global South, I'm also talking about indigenous people in the North, is that those origin stories, right, are who women of color are. That is what makes up women of color globally. There is a viable transnational women of color movements movements, feminisms, right? We understand now the cultural specificity that that's required in order to do that, but also the coalition that has to do that. Now, has Northern U.S. white middle-class feminism changed? I don't know about that. You know, what I'm saying is that, and, you know, there's a great critique that Jenny Lim has, you know, that just recently, I'm talking about the U2 movement. And she says, why was it that was important for the, you know, for the Hollywood folks, and that was important for the, you know, the Wall Street and all this kind of, all that criticism. She says, but how is the Me Too movement not about the separation of children from their mother, from their parents? Why is right. the Me Too movement not? And she just went this, you know, like, why aren't they not outraged about Asian elders being, you know, scapegoated and beaten on the streets? Why that Me Too is not happening, right? And she was right on, you know, she was right on. So I think some of the same issues, of course, and I felt that with when Hillary Clinton, you know, was running for president. Nobody wanted Trump, but it's like, but the point being is that it was like when those young women, when Hillary lost, they were horrified.
Crying.
They were crying. I thought, oh my God, it's like, I mean, I was crying too, I knew Trump was going to be horrible. But the point was, is they deeply identified with her white feminism, you know? And I thought, that's really interesting. You know, and then we can also go back and see, like, what, in terms of Obama, wasn't the hope they all thought he was going to be for a different set of reasons, right? So, but I mean, I do feel like where we are at is that I do understand, and what I think has really evolved politically, which I think is really, really, really critically important, is the role of women of color as a transnational, in terms of transnational feminisms, right? And it really being and remaining really, really culturally specific. So therefore, it's culturally specific and it's class specificity. But to be able to really, as women of color in the United States, to see ourselves as dissident against the nation state. And that has to be fundamental, you know, in terms of any kind of activism, really. And that's for all of us. And we are working against this. We're working against, you know, Latinos, you know, Latinx, you know, peoples now, you know, so many becoming Republicans, identification with the American dream and all that. And I understand the why of it, but that doesn't change the fact of it. There's always plenty of work to be done, but I think in the broad view of it, always has to be that you go from the broad view to the specificity of the conditions. And that's also what you do in writing. It's like you don't write the isms, you know, the isms is not descriptive. You have to draw very, very specific portraits, you know, of oppression and liberation for them to have any impact on human life, right? So I think that Bridge did that in a very significant way, you know, that seems to still matter.
And just to add also that Bridge was not only about race, but gender, class, and sexuality were all woven in, was all the multi-layers were in there.
Absolutely. And that's that was what made it so significant. And in the description of those multiple oppressions, there also has to be a strategy of multiple oppressions for liberation, right? And in each of our cultures within that, also have very, very, like I always used to say, you know, white women's movement. I was a young lesbian. I always said, I'm not going to find an understanding for my oppression as a lesbian, for my oppression as a Chicana lesbian, but also my desire in the bedrooms of, you know, the white suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be in the heterosexual bedrooms of Raza. Because that I was raised by my mother, and that's what she knows, right? That she, you know, it's like, so that woman, her sexuality, and, you know, ironically, the last book that I wrote with Native Country, that is, I'm watching my mother's desire, right? I mean, it's like I'm marking the specificity of it that has to do with race, that has to do with being a visible woman of color, it has to do with her class, her origin stories from the fields, all of that specificity is how we come upon an analysis that, you know, so I mean, as writers, if that's what you're called, what is your work, right? So that's my work. That's the work we're doing here. This is our work. And everybody has a different calling. And I think that it can get very overwhelming. And I see that with my students, how grand, you know, the world situation is now, the global situation is. And they just like, what, you know, like, what are we supposed to do? And they're very overwhelmed. And I always just say, just find one thing you're good at and do that. and do that with consciousness and courage. And, you know, you've got to be good. It will be good.
It will be good. Yeah.
I'm glad that you brought a desire back into it, you know, because that often kind of gets left out. And when you talk about, you know, students sometimes feel kind of scandalized, but what is held in the pages of Bridge, I think about, we just need to read that preface, you know, that I transfer and go underground, you know, like kind of the thinking that is coming together on your way to meet your lover, you know, but literally, you know, like those movements towards her, you know, and how the theory, the practice, that all kind of comes together in that. That is so much a part of it, you know, of Bridge. And that is something I think that everyone can tap into. One thing that is clear to me in teaching Bridge, I do not want students to think that the politics, the coalition politics of women of color that come out of Bridge, that is somehow the logical extension of mainstream white or hegemonic feminism. That is one thing that I have to make clear to students, that they are very deeply tied, you know, like women of color feminism or U.S. rural feminisms. And this is where Maria Lugones helps me very much, says that the very meaning of feminism is tied to the work of U.S. rural feminisms, right? And we can think of Bridge, but in no way is it an extension or the logical conclusion or, you know, it's subsumed or in anything, you know. It is not something that we can tie in that way, I guess, progressive way, right, to white feminism, because white feminism remains the way it is, right? You know, otherwise it wouldn't be. We would not have these problems, right? You know, so that's one thing I like to kind of like de-link. And also to think about how once upon a time, hopefully those days are over, but we can think about whether they are or not, a book like Bridge was a place to arrive at the end of a syllabus, right? You know, was that like now we can bring in race, gender, sexuality all together. And I certainly hope that those days are gone, because for me, this is a place where we need to begin. We need, even if it is difficult and we have to unravel it and unpack it, nonetheless, it cannot be a goal to arrive at Bridge, but to start there.
I mean, I always think what's really important is that if you read that first little invitation letter that Gloria and I came up with to try to solicit people to contribute to Bridge, it was really, you know, it was really a reaction to white women's feminism, but that's where it leaves off. I mean, that's where we let them go. We just let them go. Because what we found with each other, as I said, between the covers of a book, resonated so much more deeply. And I think that even talking to some of my friends, other, you know, black women, as a result of the Black Lives Matter movement and so much attention, you know, on a certain level, all is like, you know, you see this in academia, everybody lined up with their BLM movement, you know, support letter and all this kind of stuff. And nobody's fooled about the superficiality of that. And we were talking the other day with a friend of mine, and you know, she was just saying about just stopping. You know, I said, you know, that's what I said. I said, why can't everybody just stop and admit, you know, that one, they don't know anything. Right. And, you know, to the respectful thing to do would not be come up with all the, you know, all the perfect little language to say, yeah, you know, that we're in solidarity and we're allies and all of that superficial language, you know, to make sure that you're covered, you know, your department's covered, you know, your program's covered, you know, you did the right thing and everything. And one of the things that she and I were speaking about is that we needed each other. This is African-American woman and myself, you know, so I say we need each other. I'm much more interested in what we might have to say to each other. And, you know, last year we organized and part of this center, Las Maestras Center for Chicana Indigenous Thought, Art, and Social Practice. And one of the things that we did was we did a series on the Latinx public voice. And we did Latinx public voice in response to that nobody bothered to ask Latinos what they thought about the BLM movement. Why not? Why do white people get to talk about it? 500, you know, everything, every news thing, every, you know, democracy, now all of them, white and black, 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 white and black. And you begin to think, oh, that not just, you know, we're not even studying white people. You're looking at black people and you think, oh, they're more interested in talking to them than they are in talking to us. Right? That is an intracultural question. an intercultural, but when you're talking about people of color, intracultural in terms of this larger group of us, right? That is a profound, important thing, right? Because we need each other. But with white dominance, you know, we are like, you know, it's like they say, you know, you're always, you know, we're all always looking to the master, right? You're looking to the master narrative. The master's tools will not dismantle master's house. Audrey said it. Well, we're saying, okay, well, guess what? You know, they're still the master. I don't care. They have access to all of the white people are still the master. So where's our conversation with each other? So that's what makes still, and I don't mean just bridge, but that's what makes women of color feminism so critically important and so potentially transformational. Is we need each other. And at least what we have in common, you know, is how we understand gender. You know, at least we have, you know, it's like when, you know, I include trans women in this. At least we have that. And maybe that is enough, you know, to actually make us do truly coalition work, right? And thank you for mentioning Lugones, because she's the ever teacher of these things. And so not easily, you know, sabotaged. Not easily stolen from, right? So it's these are important things, and it still gives me energy thinking about them, you know, which always tells me something. If I still get, you know, if I still feel passionate about it, it's got to be something there that has movement. And you know, this conversation I just recently had, you know, with a colleague friend of mine, I think, oh, thank God, man, somebody's thinking, you know, it's just like we can't afford to miss each other.
This has been a wonderful conversation. We could probably go on for another hour because, Wanda, and I have more questions. But we want to mention and be sure to tell all our listeners that we invite them to come and celebrate with Las Maestras and Bridge contributors and virtual participants near and far. Friday night, it's coming up this coming Friday from 5 to 7:30 Pacific time, and folks are invited to gather in your living rooms or with your Women of Color reading group, and it's an intergenerational homage to sister, mother, grandmother, ancestor, writers, artists, and activists, and that this fifth edition, the groundbreaking anthology, this Bridge Called My Back, writings by radical women of color, edited by Sherry Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa, is available to be ordered from SUNY Press, and we will have all those links. So this is the 40th birthday celebration of this Bridge Called My Back. It's December 3rd, 5 to 7:30 California time, and folks can find the link at lasmaestrascenter.ucsb.edu, and we'll also make sure to have all the links on our website and all our social media as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Sherry Moraga, co-editor of this Bridge Called My Back, and also co-hosting with me, Wanda Alarcón. Thank you both so much for joining us on Feminist Magazine.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was wonderful. Thank you.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle@feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and via the Stitcher app on your phone, too. Thanks for listening.
Pacifica mission statement
is to establish a foundation
organized and operated exclusively for educational purposes
to encourage and supply outlets for the creative skills and energies of the community
to engage in any activity that shall contribute to a lasting understanding between nations and between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and color to gather and disseminate information on the causes of conflict between any and all of such groups, to promote the study of political and economic problems and of the causes of religious, philosophical, and racial antagonisms, to promote the full distribution of public information, to obtain access to sources